This is David Duke. It's good to be with you. This internet web broadcast is brought to you by the David Duke Report, DavidDuke.com on the internet, and by Stormfront.org. And you can find us there in the Town Hall Forum thread at stormfront.org, Town Hall. At the top of every Stormfront page, you can go there, and this is interactive radio, so you can post, and we are very anxious for you to post and continue to send us your comments, your thoughts, your ideas, your questions. I'm more than happy to answer those questions and to deal with the issues that you think are important. This is truly interactive radio. And I'm very, very glad to be with you today. We had quite a show yesterday. I think yesterday's program is quite interesting. I've already got literally a bushel of emails from all over the world about yesterday's program. Many people have told me it's the best, most informative, most interesting that they have yet heard from this broadcaster. And I hope that that's true. I hope that we continue to get better in how we broadcast the information and the ideas that are so important to us all. And so I'm working very hard to make sure that we get everything done and put everything out. Let me get these telephone lines turned off well. And get everything into a form that people can understand and appreciate. And again, what's so important, and people in the movement sometimes miss this, but what's so vitally important is that we put things in a proper tone. That we don't conform to the Jewish propaganda, the Jewish supremacist propaganda of the media about who we are and what we are, what we stand for. Because they want to make us seem as if we're people that are full of hate, people that are trying to suppress other individuals, people that don't respect other races or individuals. And the truth is, because we respect our own and want our own race respected and heritage respected, we indeed do respect other races. And the truth is that our policies will lead to more individual freedom, more expression, more diversity upon the planet for the different races of mankind, the different cultures of mankind, the different religions of mankind. Because globalism is putting forth a whole new era, a whole new cultural milieu over the earth. And we believe this globalist, Jewish supremacist system of morality, of culture, of values is a bankrupt morality. It's a bankrupt heritage. It's a bankrupt culture. It's a disgusting society. It's a society of just simply, consume and burn. It's a society where materialism is the most important thing on the planet, where morality and values go right out the window. It's a society where people are reduced to the lowest common denominators, almost like ants working for these major corporations such as Walmart, where the food we eat is not healthy, it's not good for us, where our lifestyles are not healthy and not good for us. For any of the people of the world, where our music, instead of being uplifting and idealistic and something which will motivate our young people for great achievement, or something that brings us down to the gutter. For instance, look how the MTV executives, Mr. Sumner Redstone, whose, by the way, his real name is Murray Rothstein, look at the disgusting music they're putting out around the world and promoting this gangster rap, this very primitive anti-European, anti-woman, anti-culture, anti-even living a decent and viable life. It's really something that celebrates gangsterism, murder, mayhem, violence, and all the rest. This is the kind of culture that's being grafted upon our society, and you're seeing this gangster rap now being introduced in all kinds of genres of media. Music. You can watch Walt Disney today and see, hear gangster rap in the background. You can watch a regular movie, hear gangster rap in the background. Watch a kid's Saturday morning cartoon program, hear gangster rap in the background. And this continues to seep into our culture. Every year I participate when I can, when I'm in the United States, in the St. Patrick's Day celebrations and parades that we have in Metairie in New Orleans. I've got a lot of friends in that parade, and I've marched with them for many, many years. One year I was honorary grand marshal after my election to the House of Representatives down there. And they have a lot of really wonderful marching bands, which mostly come from the Catholic schools in the area and some of the other Protestant day schools. And they have marching bands, mostly young girls. And it used to be they came by with kind of marching music or maybe some rock music. And nowadays it seems three-quarters of them come by with rap music blaring in the background. I mean, this cultural attack against our people is seeping into the very basics of our society. Now, these were not ghetto kids. And of course, the teachers and the people who are doing these, selecting the band music for these marches, these are not ghetto individuals either, for the most part. I mean, these are people who are affected by the culture, the common culture, like everyone else. And this common culture is not something which is productive. The pollution that exists upon this planet, the destruction of our heritage, our culture, the resources, this massive global consumerism that we're producing, whether it be in China, whether it be in India, whether it be in South America, whether it be in parts of the United States and Mexico, which we're also focusing on and producing with these global trade agreements and so forth. What is it producing, ladies and gentlemen? It's fouling the environment. It's destroying our own industries and viability in our own particular countries. Walmart, you know, it makes a lot of money for the Walton family, but ladies and gentlemen, what does it do to so many middle class people who have their own businesses? What does it do to those communities? It's devastating. And those people who work in Walmart, what do they make? The average Walmart employee making about $16,000 a year. You can't raise a family on that in the United States of America today. That's just the reality of it. And many of the Walmart employees are part-time employees, and they literally don't even receive certain kinds of medical attention or care or insurance. And you sure can't afford medical insurance if you're making that kind of money, that kind of low amount of money per year. The truth is that American standards over the last 30 years have really fallen. There is certainly a upper middle class which has developed in America, which is well-to-do. But the middle class of America is shrinking, and the ends of the spectrum, the very poor and some of the very rich, is expanding. And it's the truth is we've lost a lot of the quality of life today. It's very difficult for a young married family, for instance, to be able to even afford or even think about buying a home. And the home has always been, the idea to buy a home has always been one of the very basics of economic viability of a family. After a few years, you can get that home paid off, you have equity, you have some financial stability, you have something to fall back on if you have hard times, or you lose a job, or the corporation or the company moves, the factory moves, or something happens with your own business, you've got something to fall back on. And all that's going by the wayside today. And it's just amazing the loss that we've had in the United States of America. A good friend of mine, Willis Cardo, used to talk about the fact that when he was a young man in his family, his father worked as a simple conductor for one of the railways in a typical town in the United States of America. And on that conductor's salary, for a typical American railroad, he was able to have a large home. The family was able to support five children. The wife didn't have to work, and they were able to afford an automobile. That's quite a difference than today, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? Very, very different. And almost in about 60% of the American families, the wife literally has to work for the family to be able to survive. This globalism is not only bad for us economically, it's bad for us culturally, it's bad for us spiritually. It's destructive of our own particular values. It wipes out individual languages, individual music styles. It wipes out individual cultural icons and artistic expressions. And it literally will wipe off the face of the earth the beautiful expressions, the biological expressions that different races and different peoples have around the world. And isn't it great that we have this kind of diversity on the planet? These people that push this diversity for the Western world, what they're really doing is they're trying to destroy diversity. They're trying to make everybody look the same, be the same, eat the same kind of junk food, you know, have the same kind of consumer patterns, have you know, the same kind of destructive lifestyle. And ladies and gentlemen, we reject these things. We reject this attitude, and that's what distinguishes us from the people who control the system of both the United States and Europe, and indeed nowadays they're enveloping China into it and many other nations of the world. So we've got to make a change, and that's what this program's all about. It's about making a change and dealing with some of these issues straightforwardly and honestly. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's get going to the stormfront.org. And I've got some other pages up here that I've got to get aside so we can do that. Ah, there it is. Okay, so here we go. I'm going to start with Joseph Morgan, and he quotes Cain. He says, "I must say that I had the exact same question, which Duke just answered very well, about why the Jews would set themselves to be hurt by Muslims by promoting integration. And, of course, my answer to that was, of course, they set in motion certain processes which eventually hurt them. They weren't that far-sighted to see it. But their hatred of our particular culture and heritage and their seeming advantage in a multicultural society was the reason why that they supported and they dominated these kinds of policies for so long. And indeed they did. I mean, they promoted massive immigration for a long time. I quoted some of the work of Kevin MacDonald, who is one of my heroes, a great writer, a great college professor from the West Coast. And I'll give you a quote from MacDonald that Free Zundel now posted. And he says, quote, "In my research on Jewish involvement in shaping immigration policy, I found that the organized Jewish community has been the most important force favoring unrestricted immigration to the United States. In doing so, the various entities involved have consistently acted to further their own perceived collective interests, interests that are arguably in conflict with those of the majority of Americans." Yes, indeed. And one day I think I'm going to quote to you a little bit from my book, Jewish Supremacism, from the chapter I have, the Jewish-led immigration invasion. And I think you'll find that very interesting, because I can quote from Jewish scholars talking about how that they feel safer and more empowered in a multicultural society than a more homogeneous society. In other words, they fade in very easily. In fact, they say it very, very clearly, that if they continue to think about themselves and work together in a tribal sense, helping each other as a unit, as a united group, they can overcome and dominate any multicultural type society where everyone is basically reduced to atoms. Joseph Morgan says, "Another point is that the Jews outside of Israel will always be a minority in the countries that host them, 1%, 2%, etc. Numerically, they will always be in a very weak and vulnerable position. Once they set up the precedent and a culture that some groups could be excluded in the West, they see this as setting themselves up as possibly that next minority to be made unwelcome. Jews are naturally a paranoid people. There is no guarantee that the new masters of America, for example, will say, 'Yeah, we're all for multiculturalism, and just as the Jews said it's okay to exclude Muslims, we don't really care for Jews as well.'" Well, all that's true for sure. All right, and let's go to Kennewick Man. He says, quote, "Besides the red-hot anti-white hate that historically drives the Jewish political machine, they were also forced by necessity to follow the liberal agenda of the 1960s with the inclusion and import of the colored population into Western nations in the 1970s and so on. This was a logical extension of the changes they made in Western social structures. They were turning these countries into these rainbow coalitions where they, the Jews, became one of the many colorful minorities getting lost in the diverse zoo they created for us. As usual, they were a few steps ahead of the softened, submissive white majority. In the last few days, I was watching Tony Blair's angry face on CNN's European edition. Usually he talks a lot and says almost nothing. Just like Bush, he is also caught in this catch-22. No doubt any of the listeners with an IQ above 70 will automatically jump to the question, who in the hell brought these Arabs to the Western nations and why? But nobody is in a position to level the question publicly. Tony is literally talking now like he was driving for leadership position at the Idaho International Aryan Conference. He's calling for immediate deportation of radical Muslims. He wants to remove them directly from the streets, from their places of worship. He states, the rules of the game are changing. And when you've got people who may be here sometimes 20 years or more and who still don't speak English, that worries me. It worries me because I think there's a separateness there that may be unhealthy, and I think we just need to look at that. I could show Tony a few Mexicans in Los Angeles who speak less English than those Muslims. Tony and his Jew bosses are moving deeper and deeper into a swamp. They are forced to abandon the all-encompassing rainbow doctrine today, a very welcome step that might just open the gates for white nationalism tomorrow. Who knows? Maybe some of those illegal Mexicans who loose their praying mats in the Arizona desert may force the U.S. public to face the fact that there is something wrong with the open borders. There were items found in the desert on a regular basis in the last year showing that some of the illegal entries were from Muslim nations. That's interesting. And it is, again, very truthful and very, it's kind of amazing. And even the most dangerous thing I see about Tony Blair's comments, and again, they always, first of all, the Jews create this massive illegal immigration. And then it so happens a lot of the illegal immigrants have a policy in opposition to Israel they don't like, and then they try to change it. And in the process, and of course, terrorism begins in our societies. Again, terrorism that's born not simply because they hate our way of life, it's born because of policy. These Muslims do not attack the United States of America or attack Britain because of who we are. They don't attack us because we believe in democracy. They don't attack us because we have, you know, white faces. They attack us because of what we have done, because we have allowed our nations and we allow the military of our particular countries to go in and fight these wars for Israel against their own brethren. It's as simple as that. Simple as that. The idea that the attacks in London had no connection with the Iraq War is ludicrous. The idea is that the attack on the World Trade Center in 1991 had no connection with our Israeli policy is ludicrous. I mean, we can find plenty of quotes from Osama bin Laden about how he hated the United States because of its support of the criminal state of Israel, because they've supported the Israeli invasion, for instance, of Lebanon and the massive deaths it took there, because the United States had the embargo against Iraq, which killed hundreds of thousands of children. And that, by the way, is something that Madeleine Albright, our Jewish Secretary of State during the Clinton years, herself admitted to on 60 Minutes. These are the reasons why they hated us. I've never heard one word, and I've read a lot of the interviews of Osama bin Laden, I never read one word where he condemned our democracy. In fact, they really believe their viewpoint is the will of the people, and you know what? It probably is. I'm not talking about the terrorism, but I'm talking about their particular viewpoint of life and heritage and culture and religion is probably much closer to the Arab street than some of the secular leaders. He was certainly much closer to the Arab street than people like Saddam Hussein. Who had to maintain, and one reason why Saddam Hussein had to maintain his power with such a heavy hand was because most of the people in his particular country and throughout Arabia and throughout the Muslim world, you know, don't think that their leader should be truckling with Israel or with nations that truckle, if I can use that word, with Israel. In fact, Osama bin Laden had a lot of opposition to Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was one of those secular-style Arabic leaders who allowed women, for instance, to be educated and pushed for their education in universities. The women in Iraq, generally speaking, did not have to wear the veil, as, for instance, in Saudi Arabia. There was a lot more freedom in those areas. In fact, the country was very well educated, and Hussein worked very, very hard to make sure that people had an educational opportunity. And I've met, in fact, Iraqis who were educated because of the policies of Saddam Hussein. Now, all of that doesn't excuse any attacks on 9/11 or in London. And anybody who committed those kinds of atrocities against our people should be punished to the fullest extent of the law. But it's vital. It's absolutely vital that we understand why these things are happening. It's to the interest of Israel and the Jewish globalists who have so much power in the world to promote what they call World War IV. And they call it World War IV in their vernacular. They say we had World War I, World War II, then we had the Cold War, and that this is what they call World War IV. And the more they can get this war agitated, the more they kind of force the world to take sides on the side of Israel, because Israel has positioned itself supposedly on our side against the Muslim world, because, of course, they're dispossessing Muslims in Israel. So it's a tactical thing that they've done. They want this war. They want this hatred. Also, any time that they get the Arabs, their people, hating America or hating Britain rather than hating Israel, which is certainly the center of their hate there, and I might say for very, very clear causes, they have these very strong feelings toward Israel. All that lessens the pressure in Israel. Israel is very happy to know that suicide bombers are bombing in London or bombing in New York or bombing the trade towers rather than aiming their weapons, their bodies, their lives, and sacrificing their lives to strike against the Israelis. So that's it diffuses their problem. It's a benefit to them in many ways. You know, Israel has now a major pipeline that's coming from Iraq that feeds Israel the oil they want. Israel's gotten many, many benefits. Now, I saw a program the other day on CNN, and it was a good example of the absolute deceptions that exist in terms of government. I saw an individual named Allen, who was he's a senator who's on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, very high up senator in the United States of America. And there's just so much disinformation going out there and so much garbage that people don't know what to believe, and they can't make good decisions about anything. He did suggest that part of the reason for the war was, you know, the fact that we were supporting Israel. And he said as the reason for that was that Saddam Hussein was offering rewards of $35,000 to the families of suicide bombers. So they would go and attack Israel with suicide terrorist attacks. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that statement is an absolute lie. It's an absolute falsehood. And I don't know whether this senator is aware of that, or his handlers just simply tell him this, or he just heard this on the media, and he simply repeats this. But it's typical of the spin that the Jewish supremacists in the media put on the news. It's typical of that. Saddam Hussein never offered any rewards or tried to encourage in any way suicide bombers to go against Israel. In fact, he on more than one occasion condemned suicide bombers and said this is not the proper way to do it. We don't want to see civilian lives die. What he did do was offer, I think, a $25,000 cash grant to those Arabic people whose children had become suicide bombers, and then the Israelis had destroyed their home. You see, Israel has this arcane and very anti-human rights policy that if a suicide bomber, a child from a home, does a suicide bombing, then the Israeli government comes in and destroys the entire home. I mean, their parents, their brothers and sisters then lose their home. Now, I can tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. You think about this for a while. And I've read many interviews with the suicide bombers' families or the families whose kids or young people committed suicide bombing. And every one of them, everyone was regretful of the fact that their son was dead, that their son involved themselves with it. No parent wants to see his child, no matter what the cause, become a suicide bomber. I mean, literally no parent. I mean, there may be a crazy out there, but you know, you can take 100 parents. I don't care whether you talk about Muslims or Christians or Confucianists or Taoists or Buddhists or whatever. No parent wants their child to become a suicide bomber. And certainly, most of the parents who endured the fact that their child became a suicide bomber, didn't have any knowledge of the fact that they were, in fact, going to become a suicide bomber. So they tried to, if they would have, they would have tried every which way they could to stop that and save their child's life. Now, this is natural and normal, and this is true. Now, the idea that the Israelis have to destroy the home of the families is absolutely against any sort of concept of justice or law from any standpoint. It's just terrible to think to destroy someone's family because a son or daughter would do this and hurt the other children, the parents who are already suffering greatly because of the loss of their own loved one in this event. And this money, which Saddam Hussein granted to the family, was so they could rebuild their home, which the Israeli state unjustly destroyed. They would bulldoze. And by the way, almost every nation of the world, including the United States and other nations of the world, have protested and been opposed to this Jewish policy of bulldozing homes in this manner. This is not justice to have such a policy. You know, you can punish, and if an individual does something wrong, you can punish them, but you certainly don't punish their brothers and sisters. You don't punish their parents, unless those parents were involved in the actual fact of the matter themselves. That's just the way it is. And you've got to also understand what's driven on these suicide bombers. I mean, it's just incredible the suffering that the Palestinians have endured for so long. And it continues. Ladies and gentlemen, there have been literally tens of thousands of Palestinians who've been picked up by the Israeli so-called security forces, put into prison and tortured. I mean, with the worst imaginable tortures. There have been thousands and thousands of kids who've been shot down in the streets, who've suffered from missile attacks. Babies who've been burned to death in their homes from Israeli missiles and bazookas and bombs and shot by Israeli bullets. And, you know, millions and millions of acres have been stolen from Palestinian people, farms, you know, every kind of business that's been destroyed. Their roads have been blocked. Their schools have been disrupted. Schools have been destroyed. Land has been stolen from them and built these massive Jewish settlements, again, paid for by American money. And so, I mean, you can understand their feelings about this. They've had so many die. We always hear about Muslim terrorism. We don't really hear about, you know, Jewish terrorism. And maybe the Jewish terrorists are not suicide bombers, but when you let loose a missile into a Palestinian neighborhood or apartment building, or in the middle of the street where other people are killed. I mean, it always reminds me when they talk about, you know, the terror of what happened in London or the terror of what happened in New York. You know, my God, terror is terror. And when we bombed Baghdad in the beginning of the Iraq War, we actually went in and bombed housing complexes. That's right. We bombed apartment buildings. Now, we said these were government people that worked for the government, but their families live there, their wives and their children. You know, I remember the Oklahoma City bombing and how we said that those bombers, and rightfully so, that to do something without concern for the lives of those children was absolutely immoral and evil. And in fact, that was one of the points that Timothy McVeigh made in one of his statements before the court, before his death penalty was enacted against him. And by the way, people that bomb civilians, they should get the death penalty, no question about it. But I'm just saying, you've got to be consistent in these areas, ladies and gentlemen. I know I'm supposed to be painted. I'm supposed to be a bad guy and, you know, very repressive guy, former Klansman. Of course, it's been almost 30 years now, it seems. But it's just interesting how that all these liberals who condemn me for my supposed radicalism or my intolerance, they support many of these programs that kill thousands and thousands of innocent people. And I don't see any justification for it. I really don't. And I think we've got to go a different direction if we're going to avoid this kind of terrorism in the future. Because we are building up now such a tremendous hatred against America and Americans, it's going to be impossible for us to stem the tide. There are a billion Muslims in the world. And there are millions. At any one time, there are millions and millions of Americans overseas. Even if you tighten up every border, which we should be doing right now, by the way, the United States, especially the Mexican-American border, the most porous piece of our border, even if you tighten up every border, there's no way that the American government can protect all the Americans who work and are educated and get it together overseas. It's impossible to do that. And all these Americans will be absolutely at the mercy of these suicide bombers and murderers and terrorists who want to strike back at America for their own civilians who have died and their own innocent who have died in the struggle. And they will do that. And this is something we've got to de-escalate at this point. If we don't have some cool heads and some change of policies, this will continue to escalate till we truly will have the dream of these Jewish neocons. And that dream, of course, is World War IV, a world washed in blood. Joseph Morgan writes, "And when enough Muslims enter Britain, the rule makers will not be those descended from white Christendom, but the new Muslim masters of Britain. And possibly a deracinated, kowtowing white male like Blair is being nudged toward this rhetoric by Jewish influence. There must be some real interesting infighting in Jewish circles about Muslim integration into the West. On the one hand, if they promote Muslim exclusion from the West, they are setting a precedent that might trap them when non-whites are the majority. On the other hand, Muslims might be a difficult to manipulate mass that could end Western support of Israel and so its demise, and create changes in our culture that creates a consensus among people of color that purges might be an order of Jews from their vital seats of power in the media, academia, and government." Very interesting, and it's all so true. And I often make this point that even though the Jews have this overwhelming amount of power, which they've displayed and they've exercised for a long time, you know, they're not omniscient, and they make mistakes. And sometimes they can set into motion certain forces that can later come up and bite them on the arse. And that's what's happening to a certain degree. I want to say something else, though, too, that one reason why they promote the multiculturalism, one reason they do it is because their policy has always been divide and conquer. And even though this one issue of Israel is a very important issue to them, they're able to get many of the other issues taken care of because of this divide and conquer strategy and the fact that they can use different groups against each other. I'll give you an example. I mean, you know, before the so-called Voters' Rights Act, when Louisiana was overwhelmingly white voters, I would have been elected by a landslide to the United States Senate and to the governorship of Louisiana by a landslide. So it's in their interest, whenever they can have vast majorities, and then they can simply play up those minorities' grievances, sense of solidarity, their anger, whatever they need to do to go against or for the candidate that they so choose. So that's another way that they're able to do what they do, is they're able to take these minorities and fire them up in one way or the other. I'll give you an example in Britain. Tony Blair is basically a liberal. He's a member of the Labour Party. And then you have the Conservatives. But they're both conservatives and the liberals are like handmaidens of Israel. All right, the only party that's truly against the against really the powers of international Zionism and really has shown to be so, the only political party that's done that is the British National Party. It's also a party, though, that wants to preserve the ethnic heritage of Great Britain and continue to see Britain to become British and not Muslim or not some other heritage. So what do you have? Now, the British National Party obviously would pose a great threat to the Jewish supremacists. But they know that by having a lot of Muslims in that area, they can play off. And they can make these Muslims think their big enemy is the British National Party because they're for preserving Britain as it is, which is the most natural thing that anybody would want. I mean, again, Muslims in their own countries would want to preserve their own society, no question about it. And but the point is that way they divide and conquer, and they keep a truly anti-Zionist party from gaining power in Britain, and so you still have these massive Western, which is controlled again by the Jewish supremacists, this massive Western incursions and military presence in the third world, in the Muslim world specifically. committing so many of these atrocities against those individuals. This is from Joseph Morgan. Again, he says, with internet technology, then the next step would take a Meet the Press roundtable every Sunday and add special guests to join the panel. For instance, Strom, Whitaker, and Duke bring on Jean-Marie Le Pen as a guest, or Nick Griffin bring on Professor Kevin MacDonald or Mark Weber. Bring on the pro-white singer Travon Tucker or popular Lamb and Lynx of Prussian Blue. That's true. We need to develop that media, and we're certainly moving toward that end. This is from Messiah. He says, good morning, Bob. Good morning, everyone. Bob, I hope your tooth is feeling better. Here's a couple things I've been thinking about today. Who's behind the war with Iran? And he talks about some other issues that we are not going to be able to go into here. This is from Spiro. He says, Representative Duke, how much have you noticed the growth in the vocalness of European Americans? It seems like more whites are speaking their minds today than a decade or two ago. As more whites speak out, do you think this will embolden the otherwise quieter like minds? Well, Spiro, I am absolutely certain that that's exactly what will happen. Again, we talk about building consensus. You have to reach a critical mass. So we found that in my campaigns in Louisiana. When in my district saw this sea of Duke yard signs, and it became okay, and people realized that we had a chance to win, and the whole consensus changed. And that's what we have to do on a nationwide basis. In fact, that's what we've got to do across the entirety of the West, and that's exactly what we're working toward right now. Okay, Harry Bird says, I saw the president bragging about his economic programs working. He bragged about creating so many jobs, but didn't mention how bad the pay and benefits are. He also rationalized CAFTA by saying it would create jobs because people will be able to find a job so they don't have to sneak in here to get one. What an idiot and a traitor. Boy, that's the truth. What an idiot and a traitor. Kevro says, Mr. Duke, should a religious person put religion or a race first? Well, that's a question, Kevro. That's one of those psychological questions. Let me tell you something. There's no reason to have a conflict there. Absolutely. To me, part of my religious belief, part of my spiritual belief, is the understanding that race exists, that race is a creation of nature, and if you choose to say a creation of God, this force in the universe that's created these unique kinds of humanity. And so everyone must make a determination of what their religious view is about race and about life and about politics and the rest of it. And that's your determination. And I don't believe it's up to the priests. I don't think it's up to the ministers. I think every person can have their own personal relationship with God, with the infinite, with the forces of nature. You have your own relationship there. And I think that you can be religious and absolutely be consistent and want to preserve your race and be determined to defend your race and your heritage from those who would commit genocide against you. It's funny, no religion on this planet would condemn someone for trying to prevent the genocide of their people, and yet that's precisely what's going on against us. So it's not a question of putting religion or race first. It's a question of making a determination in your own mind, your own heart, your own spirit, whether you think preserving your race is in line with your spiritual beliefs. Now, if a particular religious denomination or organization that you're participating in has a very overt anti-position that's advocating your genocide as a race, you have absolutely the right to oppose that and absolutely the right to have a different conscientious position toward that. That's called freedom of conscience, and you should. And I believe that many people will go to Sunday school and go to church. If the preacher starts preaching this, or they preach it in Sunday school, you're doing nothing wrong when it comes to that question and answer session or in Sunday school to raise your hand and say, I don't think that's right, and here's why. You know, God created these different races. He created the white race. He created the black race. He created the yellow race. Did God make a mistake? Are we evil to try to preserve what God himself created? If he wanted us to be all one race, why wouldn't he have made us one race? We can still treat people decently and still respect our own heritage and want to preserve our own heritage. And there's nothing wrong with people preserving their own heritage. You see my point? I mean, it's you just have to learn how to do that, and you really can do that. Jared Weatherington says, Representative Duke, I realize in the whole scheme of things this may sound like an insignificant issue. However, I was curious as to your opinion regarding the decline of American sports within the last 50 years. I don't know if you ever were an avid sports fan yourself, although I know there's some staunch football fans at LSU. Recently, the ultra-politically correct NCAA banned the use of Indian mascots in the postseason. Whites in high school are encouraged to participate in sports, yet they receive little chance of getting an athletic scholarship because they have to compete with blacks. Typically, black violence is blamed on poverty, yet we see the same behavior exhibited by multimillionaire black athletes. Are you disheartened by the deterioration of American sports since integration? You know, I don't know if I'm disheartened by it. I think that the forced integration of sports and transforming a lot of these illiterate criminal individuals into heroes, I think, is very degenerative and very damaging to the American people, and particularly to European Americans, undoubtedly. When I went to LSU at first, in fact, in 19... I don't want to discuss how long that was ago. In 68, our football team was all white. In fact, it was that way for three more years before we had the first black in the team. And we had a great time. And our teams, by the way, were in the top 10 of the country every year. People that say that we can't compete, you know, having that kind of team, there are certain advantages. I mean, black athletes, generally speaking, are a bit faster. They have a faster – there's actually physical difference between whites and blacks. We know that. That's the truth. Not every black is faster than every white, any more than every white is more intelligent than every black. But most whites have a higher intelligence than blacks. That's just a fact of the matter. Every IQ study that's been done in the United States of America proves this point. And the fact of the matter is that the average black has more speed in certain areas than the average white person. And that's speed is a big advantage in games such as basketball, football, and track, and this type of thing. There is a very distinct there's a very distinct difference there. Now, I believe the differences are big enough that whites basically should compete against whites, and blacks should compete against blacks. I think that's what makes sense to me. Because that way, more of the individual's effort is rewarded rather than simply doing what we're doing today, which is very frustrating, obviously, to the white athlete. And just as other things are very frustrating to blacks. I think that's one reason why I think black community is healthier for blacks. They're among their own people, and they can compete more fairly. If a black is in an integrated school and they're struggling against a lot of whites who happen to have a higher IQ, and it makes it much more difficult for them to keep up grade-wise, it's very frustrating. It causes anger and dispossession. And in the black community itself, a sense of self-worth, and other things like that come with being among your own people. A good example is the famous Supreme Court decision. Boy, I'm going over time today. As usual, I've been going over time a lot in the programs recently. The original Supreme Court decision that started the integration movement, the 54 Supreme Court decision, was based on the idea that dolls, that blacks who played with Black students who went to school with whites preferred, white dolls. I mean, blacks who went to school with blacks preferred white dolls more than black dolls. The fact is that they didn't talk about the fact that that blacks who went to school with whites preferred the white dolls at even a higher rate. I think that each race has its own particular range of talents and abilities, and it just makes more sense for them to work together. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm done. I've got actually a couple more emails I'd like to have been able to share with you today, but I'm going to have to do that tomorrow with you, and I will look forward very much to being with you tomorrow. And until then, all I can tell you is God bless and take care. And let's get this program out. This will be archived very quickly, and we'll get this thing going very quickly out on the airwaves. All right, thanks everybody, and take care. God bless you, and let's go to work and spread this these ideas and these values and this truth all over the Western world.
This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.